Tensions on the rise between the U.S. and China. Shutting down diplomatic missions is one way to go, but
there are real concerns about Chinese espionage and theft, but in my opinion, we should be using a scalpel rather than a hammer to address them.
Also, the pandemic has changed so many things, including how we grieve. Mental health professionals worry about the long-term impacts.
We can really expect that there is going to be a tsunami of suffering.
And many Puerto Ricans have relocated to some key swing states. The challenge now, getting them politically engaged.
Most Puerto Ricans have lost hope in the political system.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Happy Monday. It is good to be with you. Now 6 months or so since the coronavirus ripped across much of the globe, do you know how to go about getting tested? What about the specific COVID test to ask for? It is confusing, so why is that? And is it different in other countries? We asked Rajiv Shah to talk this through with us. He ran the U.S. Agency for International Development from 2010 to 15. In his current role as president of the Rockefeller Foundation, Dr. Shah has proposed that the U.S. government spend $75 billion on expanding COVID testing, increasing the number of tests from 4.5 million to 30 million a week. Dr. Shah, it feels like in many places across the U.S., it's pretty much up to individual Americans to figure out how to get tested for COVID. Am I wrong about that, and why is that?
Well, America needs a stronger approach to testing in order to get ahead of the coronavirus crisis. In the United States, as you know, we've had the past week somewhere between 60 and 70,000 new cases a day. There's every indication that this fall will be considerably worse than the spring. And the Rockefeller Foundation brought together scientists, industry leaders, frankly, bipartisan Republican and Democratic former expert officials, and said, what can we do to get out of this bind? And the answer was more testing, more frequent testing, more accurate testing, and a stronger response and investment in a national testing action plan that can reach 30 million tests a week.
And Dr. Shah, before we go on, just make the connection for us between testing and reopening the economy. Why is testing vital to getting back to normal?
Well, testing is the only way out. Right now we have a choice between shutting down the economy, which, by the way, the losses disproportionately sit on the shoulders of low-income and minority Americans in particular, or forcing institutions to be active and open. And we know that the contact that then ensues will lead to hundreds of thousands of deaths. And neither option is sustainable for the American people. For America to get through this and be strong, we need a testing strategy that allows you to take yourself out of the chain of transmission quickly if you're positive.
So how does this work in other countries? Let's just talk about the straight up testing first. In places like China, South Korea, Germany, countries that have been successful in containing the spread of the virus, how have they gone about administering COVID tests?
Well, the first thing they did was most of them built strong relationships with industry. In South Korea, they very quickly pulled together a public-private partnership between public health authorities and local industry. They manufactured very large volumes of rapid tests, and they made testing ubiquitous. When you arrived on an airplane, you got tested. When you are in a community and you go to a school, you get tested and get the result quickly. Second, those testing systems were tied very closely to contact tracing. We know that almost all the spread, or at least the majority of the spread, happens in the first few days after testing positive. So if it takes 4, 5, 6, 7 days to get a result, then that test is sort of useless. If the test turns around in 15 minutes, an hour, and it's tied to effective self-isolation and contact tracing, it can work very well. That's what you saw in South Korea. It's what you see in Singapore. Mm. It's what you're seeing in Germany. And it's what you saw across the Nordic countries that did a very good job of the basics.
So are you saying that you've got to have both testing and contact tracing? That's got to be the strategy. You just can't have testing without contact tracing.
Yeah, that's true. I will say, I led the Ebola response in West Africa during 2014, and we worked very hard to get the testing down from 8 to 9 days to get a result to under 4 hours. And we did everything we could to do that. And that's because you cannot do contact tracing without the data that comes from testing.
So when it comes to testing, was getting a rapid test the lesson from the Ebola outbreak in West Africa in 2014?
Yeah, getting a rapid turnaround. Ironically, the test itself was not as rapid there. We had to, you know, use helicopters to fly blood samples from rural Liberia to a, you know, U.S. bioterror lab that we put down in order to make laboratory capacity more accessible in a place that simply didn't have it. America, on the other hand, this is America. I mean, we have a tremendous amount of resources in our national and in our public and private healthcare system. We need to unlock it, because it would be a real shame if the testing technology exists, the FDA's approved it, but we simply don't have enough material, enough kits, enough product on the market for America's schools, nursing homes, hospitals, health facilities, and other critical services.
Rajiv Shah is president of the Rockefeller Foundation from 2010 to 2015. He ran the U.S. Agency for International Development. That was during the West Africa Ebola outbreak. Dr. Shah, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
In Bolivia, the government has now postponed presidential elections three times this year. The pandemic is the problem, but there's also a growing political crisis in the country. The World's Jorge Valencia brings us a story of one mayor who's become a symbol of a divided country.
The city of Vinto is in the heart of Bolivia's agricultural country, and Mayor Patricia Arce has been in office since 2015. She says the job is similar now to what it was before the pandemic.
La alcaldía es como una oficina de quejas.
Running City Hall is like running a complaints office, she says.
Que si no pasó el carro basurero, que si no hay luz, que si no hay agua.
Arce says people will call if the garbage truck hasn't come by or if the power or water service has been cut off. But she says in the last 3 months, she's also been trying to help the local hospital. And she's been delivering grocery baskets to people affected by the pandemic. I've lost count of the number of baskets, she says. She explains she and a team have been delivering food when they hear of families going hungry. But she's been doing her job under the cloak of fear, because Vinto, like the rest of Bolivia, is in political crisis. Last November, a mob of protesters torched City Hall in the city of Vinto, and they dragged Mayor Arce for about 3 miles, forcibly cut her hair and doused her in red paint. In this video that went viral across Bolivia, Arce sits drenched in red paint as someone cuts chunks of her hair and protesters scream demanding her resignation. One man asks, "What have you done?" And she replies defiantly, "The only thing I've done is work for my people." Her case is one of dozens of human rights violations perpetrated under Bolivia's interim national government this year. That's according to a report out today from Harvard Law School and the nonprofit University Network for Human Rights. Co-author Thomas Becker says they interviewed more than 200 people.
Ranging from victims, eyewitnesses, government officials, police, prosecutors, military, human rights observers.
Becker says the violence started just after former President Evo Morales was forced out of the country last November. Morales had been reelected for a fourth term in a controversial vote. The Bolivian military later attacked pro-Morales protesters. Becker, who's an attorney, says he was working in the city of Sacaba when the first confrontation happened.
And saw the blood on the streets, the bullet holes in the wall, and this is horrific what happened. So that day I started trying to measure the trajectory of the bullets. All the bullet holes we saw that day all pointed to the bridge where the soldiers were stationed.
The military killed dozens of civilians in two protests just after the elections, according to numerous reports. Carwell Bjork-James is a professor of anthropology at Vanderbilt University who studies social movements in Bolivia. He says the country has a history of mass protests leading to transitions of power.
What you expect to have, and what Bolivia actually has been very good since 1982 and having until 2019, is some kind of neutral caretaker period, a period when the different political forces have to face off one another and things are going to get resolved at the ballot box.
But Bjork-James says the administration of interim president Jeanine Añez has been more extreme than any of her political rivals. He says Añez has ordered dozens of investigations of local government officials and social leaders, accusing them of subverting the constitution. It's a crime referred to as sedition.
And it's extremely ironic to have a transitory government that came into power after 3 weeks of protest demanding the removal of the existing government to immediately turn around and use sedition as one of the major crimes that it arrests people for.
Patricia Arce, the mayor of Vinto, says she asks herself how Bolivia wound up in this political mess.
Nos costó tanto avanzar para...
We fought too hard for our rights to lose them this way, Arce says. And the way out of the crisis is not any more clear. Elections officials have now postponed the presidential vote to mid-October, citing a rising number of coronavirus cases. Authorities have not given any indication about how they would conduct elections during the pandemic. For the World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
In Russia's Far East, more than 4,000 miles away from Moscow, a summer of discontent rolls on. The people of Khabarovsk and other cities and towns in the region have been protesting for 3 weeks now. The largest one happened over the weekend. Tens of thousands of people marching in the streets. The World's Daniel Offman joins me now. He's been following these protests closely. Remind us, Daniel, how these protests started.
It all started with an arrest. Earlier this month, Sergei Furgal, who is a popular governor in the Khabarovsk region, was arrested on charges of murder and attempted murder, a case that goes back 15 years. And as a result, the protests started. Now, protesters and other critics believe that these charges against their governor, Sergei Furgal, are trumped up and that, in fact, he was arrested for political reasons.
So what is the Kremlin's beef with this governor?
Well, it all comes down to popularity. Furgal was very popular in the Khabarovsk region, and his approval rating was even higher than that of Vladimir Putin. So as a result, after he was unexpectedly arrested and flown back to Moscow, thousands of protesters came out to the streets. And over the weekend, on Saturday, there were reports that 50,000 people were protesting, and that doesn't happen very often in Russia.
So as I said, Khabarovsk is about 4,000 miles away from Moscow. What is Putin's main worry?
Well, Putin always seeks legitimacy. So when thousands of people come out to the streets and protest, he's worried that they're going to spread and that undermines his legitimacy as the president of Russia.
What exactly are protesters demanding? And over the past 3 weeks or so, have they gotten anything?
Well, they have many demands, but their number one demand is that they want Sergei Furgal, the governor who was arrested, they want him back in the Far East. They want his trial to take place in Khabarovsk, in his city. And aside from that, protesters are chanting for change. They're chanting for freedom. They're chanting down with Putin. And so far, the Kremlin has ignored all of their demands.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask, I mean, hasn't the Russian government said or done anything to address the unrest in Khabarovsk?
So for starters, Russian state media hasn't really been paying much attention to the region, and mostly they've been reporting on the dangers of protesting during the time of the coronavirus pandemic. However, the government has responded. President Putin has appointed a new governor for the region. His name is Mikhail Dikhtirov. I spoke with a political activist from the Khabarovsk region. His name is Sergei Naumov, and he told me people aren't happy about the new governor. So Sergei is saying that the appointment of the new governor is a slap in the face to the people of the Khabarovsk region. Think about it. Their governor gets arrested, and just a couple of weeks later, Moscow brings in the replacement, someone who isn't from the region and someone who's likely to fall into line with the Kremlin.
Daniel, where does this go from here? How will the appointment of this new governor actually affect the protest movement that's been happening?
So one of the most surprising aspects of the protests from over the past 3 weeks is that overall they've been peaceful, but not in all cases. So that's Sergei Naumov again, the political activist. He said there has been some violence. He told me that on Saturday, he was followed by someone as he was walking towards the protest, and he decided to confront the guy while recording a video. And as a result, the man knocked his phone out of his hands and started beating him up. So Sergei suspects that there are scores of Kremlin operators in the streets of Khabarovsk who are trying to instigate violence and trying to scare political activists. But even after that encounter, Naumov believes that the protests themselves will remain peaceful.
The World's Daniel Offman, we're counting on you to keep your eyes on the situation in eastern Russia moving forward. Thanks very much for this.
Thanks, Marco.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Here in the U.S., it matters less how many votes a presidential candidate gets, so much as it does where the votes come from. Hillary Clinton was reminded of that the hard way 4 years ago. Won the popular vote by some 3 million, but lost the Electoral College. Puerto Ricans have emerged as a key demographic in some key swing states. About 4 million Puerto Ricans eligible to vote are living in the U.S., a number that continues to rise. As the world's Daisy Contreras explains, they've got political power.
The winds are ferocious right now, gusting above 120 miles per hour, severing the tops of the palm trees. And
in 2017, Hurricane Maria devastated Puerto Rico, and thousands fled to the U.S. School enrollment records show most settled in Florida and Pennsylvania.
A lot of these people didn't come from the island with documents.
Charito Morales is an organizer with Fili Boricuas in Pennsylvania.
A lot of the students or youth didn't come with the a report card from school because it was no electricity, it was no communication. A lot of them couldn't prove they was Puerto Rican, even though they came from the island of Puerto Rico, and it was a lot of hurt.
Morales and other groups mobilized to get the new arrivals help. Then they thought about their voting potential. Puerto Ricans are citizens by birth, but they can't vote for president or members of Congress unless they move to the U.S. Then suddenly they have a say. Even as the Puerto Rican diaspora in the U.S. grows, some Puerto Ricans don't think their vote matters, says Jose Lopez. He's a historian and leads the Puerto Rican Cultural Center in Chicago.
So when you look at Puerto Ricans coming here, I think most Puerto Ricans have lost hope in the political system. So in that process, it's very hard to get them involved and engaged because there's a sense of hopelessness.
That hopelessness, says Lopez, is largely rooted in the island's colonial history. First under Spanish rule, then under the U.S. as a territory. More recently, Puerto Rico's economy has been in crisis and made worse by natural disasters. So when Puerto Ricans move to the U.S., they face a new political landscape in terms of who and what they're voting for, says Carlos Vargas Ramos. He's with the Center for Puerto Rican Studies in New York.
Politics in Puerto Rico, by and large, are framed in terms of its political relationship with the United States. It is whether you want to remain a territory of the United States as a commonwealth, change that relationship into perhaps more autonomy, or join the United States as a state on equal footing with the other 50 states of the Union.
Vargas Ramos says those most likely to vote in U.S. elections are Puerto Ricans who were born in the U.S. or who have many years living here.
These are people who in the United States were already mobilized by the plight in Puerto Rico, and they are the ones pushing and pressing elected officials to provide assistance to Puerto Rico. Those are the ones that are very likely to turn out to vote.
But if newcomers to the U.S. can be mobilized, renew their faith in politics, their vote could make a difference, says Lopez, the historian in Chicago. He points to recent events on the island. Last year, Puerto Ricans demanded their governor, Ricardo Rosselló, step down.
Hoy les anuncio que estaré renunciando al puesto del gobernador efectivo el viernes 2 de agosto de 2019.
And he did, after being investigated for corruption, and many celebrated. If the diaspora grasps that kind of enthusiasm, says Lopez, a shift can happen in the U.S. too, in states like Pennsylvania, Florida, and Ohio. In 2016, President Donald Trump won Pennsylvania by about 44,000 votes. If enough Latinos, enough Puerto Ricans vote, that could change this November, says Lopez.
I would say we have an amazing moment.
People on the ground are trying to seize this moment, including Charito Morales, the community organizer in Philadelphia.
Presten atención, localización del colegio electoral.
She took to Facebook Live to reach the community before the June primaries. Pay attention, she says. Morales and her group want to get the Puerto Rican diaspora out to vote in November.
¿Quieren hacer el cambio? ¿Quieren traer más fondos? ¿Quieren tener más recursos?
Morales asks if people want change, if they want more funding for their communities and more resources.
Pues aprendan a votar. La responsabilidad es de todos. Buenas tardes.
She says, learn to vote. It's everyone's responsibility. For the world, I'm Daisy Contreras.
On the island of Puerto Rico itself, they're fighting, like the rest of the globe, the coronavirus. Dr. Andres Julia Beltran is an epidemiologist working to contain the spread of the coronavirus in the Puerto Rican city of Yauco. Dr. Beltran told me he thinks Puerto Rico has lost control of the coronavirus.
In the hospital, we have today more than 500 people with COVID, and that's a record in Puerto Rico.
Right. So no doubt there is no one easy explanation for why it's not under control in Puerto Rico. But I do know the island had been encouraging more tourism from the U.S. mainland, but then cases spiked and the governor had to roll back reopening efforts. Was reopening really a big setback for the island?
When the country reopened, I think that we let our guard down. We are seeing since the reopening that the cases are going higher and higher and higher every day. Most of the cases are from not just tourists, but people that came back from the States because in Yauco, the earthquake, people fly to their family home back in the state, and they come back to Puerto Rico, to Yauco. They come back with the virus, specifically for people from Florida and Texas. We have a lot of Puerto Rican community in those states.
Right, and we know that Florida and Texas have been highly impacted. When tourists or any visitors arrive on the island, are they tested?
Not all of them are tested. I have travelers that come from Florida, and they told me that they just come off of the airplane, took their baggage, and go to the street. My concern is that when people come from the state, they are going to visit their family, hugging each other, kissing. And that's why the family reunion with travelers is a very big concern for me.
What is COVID transmission like in the city where you're working, Yauco?
Most of the COVID transmission right now in Yauco are from occupational exposure.
And
right now.
Explain what that means. So people going.
Like four big contagion lines from family that start. The initial case was people that came from the work. So a big family contagion line that I have in Yauco start with a woman that worked with the security company. Another one worked in the fast food. Another one worked in a factory.
Dr. Julia, I think of what Puerto Rico has been through in recent years, Hurricane Maria, earthquakes, severe flooding. As a doctor, what are you seeing in terms of the mental health toll on Puerto Ricans?
First, in January, we are afraid to live inside our home because with the earthquake, we can sleep inside the home. Now, we can get outside of the house. So if you are asking for the mental health, it's a very big concern for me. To me, it's sad.
Thank you very much. Good luck.
Thank you.
Dr. Andres Julia Beltran is an epidemiologist working to contain the spread of the coronavirus in the Puerto Rican city of Yauco. You're listening to The World. Israel took swift action to halt the coronavirus in the spring. Kids were sent home and then back to the classroom.
We did not feel like we had any adequate time to prepare for that in order to make sure that the school was appropriately equipped.
Israel tries to learn from its mistakes. Still ahead, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of WGBH Boston and PRX. The coronavirus is spreading in Africa at an alarming rate. The World Health Organization's emergencies chief, Michael Ryan, expressed special concern for the sub-Saharan region.
South Africa may unfortunately be a precursor. It may be a warning for what will happen in the rest of Africa.
South Africa has the most cases of any country on the continent, nearly 450,000. And now South Africa is returning to its strict pandemic lockdown as cases are spiking everywhere across the continent. Dr. John Nkenga Song is the director for the Africa Center for Disease Control and Prevention in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Doctor, good to have you with us again. Let's begin in South Africa, which has had one of the strictest lockdown requirements I can recall through the pandemic. Alcohol sales have been banned, a rigid curfew in place. COVID-19 cases were low, but now as South Africa and other countries have been opening back up again, we're seeing this dangerous second surge. So what happened in South Africa?
So South Africa is, of course, is a very disturbing situation for the continent. As we speak today, the continent of Africa, all 55 member states have now recorded cases of COVID-19, resulting to about 846,000 And of that, more than half cases are from South Africa. South Africa did all the right things to start with. Only had about 700 cases, the lockdown, the economies, increased testing, contact tracing. I think we know that this is a virus that transmits very quickly. And once it gets hold into very vulnerable populations, it can spread rather quickly.
Right. Well, there is this really fine balance that governments need to consider with lockdowns. On the one hand, the science shows us these measures are keeping the coronavirus at bay. On the other, they're having a detrimental effect on the economies the longer they're in place. Have economic problems actually aggravated public health strategies, like in South Africa?
So the key question here is, how do we balance between saving lives and saving economies, and not saving lives or saving economies? I think that formula cannot hold. We cannot be under lockdown forever. We have to go out there and fight the virus and intensify aggressive, bold public health measures, taking public health measures that work in the United States, in Europe, and elsewhere, and implementing it in Africa would not work. I think that is one. Second is that we need to be bold in doing what we have to do. Like, about more than 40 countries in Africa still have less than 5,000 cases of COVID infection. That is an opportunity where we can massively deploy foot soldiers, that is contact tracers. Okay, I want to see a country like Nigeria put in about 1 million contact tracers, young people that can support their testing program so that the testing delays are reduced. That is the turnaround time so that we can action on that. That is what the tools that we have on our hands right now. Otherwise, I don't know how we are going to fight this back.
There are allegations in South Africa of corruption, of vendors charging absurdly high rates for masks and hand sanitizer. I'm just wondering, how has South Africa's history of corruption affected the response to coronavirus? And do you worry how corruption could impact other parts of the continent's response to the coronavirus?
When you have an outbreak of this nature, any nature for that matter, you see all kinds of behaviors. And I think there are people that will go in and try to explore the situation. We saw that with HIV/AIDS, and we saw that with the massive Ebola outbreak in West Africa. So the COVID-19 would not be an exception. I think we at Africa CDC and the African Union Commission are very clear that this is a serious threat for the continent. People that try to see this as a money-making opportunity are really making a fatal mistake, and this should not at all be accepted, be tolerated, and be condoned. I think it should be condemned with the strongest possible terms.
You've got such a massive sphere of operations and responsibilities, from the southern coast of the Mediterranean all the way down to South Africa's Cape of Good Hope. What are you urgently advising African governments to do to keep this next wave, this likely next wave of coronavirus, stabilized?
Quite honest with you, we haven't even done yet with the first wave. I mean, that is, let's be very frank with ourselves. I think we have to rely on the tools that we have in our toolkits. Very importantly is that only human resources, okay, will be able to combat this. This is about investing in human capital to fight this infection in a coordinated way across the board. So I fully understand the challenge, but it's a challenge that we have to deal with. Take it in our hands, look at it, and say, this is our continent, this is our future, and we have to win this fight in order to survive.
Dr. John Nkengasong is the director for the Africa Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Doctor, thank you very much for joining us again.
You're welcome. Always a pleasure.
This morning in Chengdu, China, a momentous day, a flag-lowering ceremony marked the official closure of the U.S. consulate there.
I hereby officially retire our national colors and present them to you in recognition of the official closure of the United States consulate in Chengdu, China, effective 1000 hours, this 27th day of July, in the year of our Lord, 2020.
China forced today's closure as a response to last week's decision by the Trump administration to close the Chinese consulate in Houston. Jessica Chen Weiss is a political scientist at Cornell University and an expert on Chinese foreign policy. How significant is the closure of a consulate? I mean, the Chinese government has called the closure of the Houston consulate an unprecedented political provocation. Do you agree, at least when it comes to U.S.-China relations?
It's a significant development, and it's certainly visually arresting. And I think it's a sign of the dramatic downturn almost like death spiral in U.S.-China relations as the Trump administration races toward the November election, motivated by an electoral strategy that sees getting tough on China as a good way to divert attention from the administration's disastrous response to the pandemic, as well as a set of hawkish officials inside the Trump administration looking to make use of a closing window to accelerate a decoupling in U.S.-China relations.
So the Trump administration has cited espionage as one reason for the closure of the Chinese consulate in Houston. How much do you think the closure is based on real national security concerns versus an attempt to distract, as you say, by the Trump White House?
There are real concerns about Chinese espionage and theft, but in my opinion, we should be using a scalpel rather than a hammer to address them. Research has shown the value of having face-to-face diplomacy. Having fewer on-the-ground contacts and channels makes it harder for the United States and China to communicate and diffuse the growing tensions.
Both countries have a few more consulates in both places, the U.S. and China, and China in the U.S. Would you be surprised if this tit-for-tat of consulate closures just continues until both countries are just left with kind of symbolic embassies? And where would the U.S. and China be at that point?
Well, it really depends, I think, right now on what the Trump administration does. China, I think, picked the Chengdu consulate as a carefully calibrated retaliation meant to signal that China was going to give as good as it gets, but not try to escalate the situation further. And we'll just have to see what happens on the U.S. side now.
What does this mean then for U.S.-China relations? I mean, because there are accusations of espionage, closed diplomatic channels. It feels very Cold War with potential for more escalation. Is that what's going on?
We have seen Chinese officials indicating an interest in exploring potential off-ramps. I'm not sure that we have the political will on the U.S. side to try to diffuse the confrontation that it seems to me they very much want. That dynamic, I think, is likely to continue leading up to November, and we'll have to see whether a prospective Biden administration, should one take office, pursue a different tack.
There's some suspicion, Professor, that even if President Trump sullies the play settings for the next occupant of the White House, given the turmoil of democracy pushback in Hong Kong, the oppression of ethnic minorities in Western China, these issues around intellectual property, I mean, won't the next administration have to accept a period of antagonism with China at the very least?
There's no question that tensions in U.S.-China relations are here to stay. There are too many fundamental differences and disagreements. But a new administration might seek to confine those areas of tension so that they don't overtake the entirety of the relationship and preclude pragmatic cooperation on everything from fighting the ongoing pandemic to trying to do more to mitigate climate change.
Jessica Chen Weiss, a political scientist at Cornell University specializing in Chinese foreign policy. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This Sunday marked the 30th anniversary of a milestone in American civil rights law.
I now lift my pen to sign this Americans with Disability Act and say, let the shameful wall of exclusion finally come tumbling down. God bless you all.
The ADA, signed as you heard there by President George H.W. Bush, barred discrimination against people with disabilities. It outlined their rights to reasonable accommodations in public life. South Korea has similar protections for its disabled citizens. And just like in the U.S., Koreans with disabilities continue to push for greater inclusion. From Seoul, reporter Jason Strother tells us about one of those advocates.
Hong Seol-yoon leads me on a tour of Doksogong, a former royal palace.
Have you been to this palace many times?
Of course. Maybe once a week. A lot of times, yeah.
Outside, performers are playing instruments and dressed in colorful 19th century costumes. Hong and I zigzag around the tourists snapping photos. At the palace's wooden gate, I walk over a step. Hong rolls up a small ramp.
Do you find this palace particularly accessible for someone using a wheelchair?
So actually, the palace, they renovate the years ago and they put some slope for the wheelchair.
Hong is founder of Tourism for All Korea, a nonprofit that advocates for inclusive travel. Her work helped shape the creation of a center for tourists with disabilities in Seoul. She created a guide to accessible sites and businesses, and she's pushed the city to provide more low-deck buses for wheelchair users. Hong says many of these improvements benefit everyone, the elderly, pregnant women, and parents pushing strollers, too.
Disabled or not, they have same needs. Like, they want to travel, they want to visit. I think that's not different.
Hong was 10 years old when she was paralyzed after a swimming pool accident. She says at that time, Korea wasn't accessible at all for wheelchair users.
So in my high school and middle school days, a lot of discrimination. Even, like, I cannot really go to school because there was no elevator in that time. Even teachers didn't know how to teach disabled students. That was a really hard time.
Instead of sending her to a school for disabled children, Hong's family moved to the Philippines. They felt the country was more caring toward people with disabilities. As a teen, Hong sometimes felt depressed about her situation, but a teacher helped her gain confidence. One thing he told her stands out.
Disabled is not a abnormal. It is just an uncomfortableness. Just do whatever you want to do. It impacts me a lot. It really changed my life.
Hong returned to South Korea for university. By then, she had learned to advocate for herself. Like when her school refused to relocate a class from the upper floor of a building that had no elevator. Hong fought back and won. The class was moved. South Korea finally passed an anti-disability discrimination law in 2007. Hong says one of the best things she can do to get rid of lingering prejudice is to help make disability more visible.
네. 네, 그리고
먼저 하겠습니다. 네. 안녕하세요. 저는 유럽 7개 나라 26개 도시를 휠체어로 타고 돌아오는
She's been a panelist on a nationally broadcast TV show about disability issues. And after backpacking through Europe, Hong wrote a book about her travels, the first of its kind in Korea. She says at first, publishers weren't interested.
Two companies denied to write my book. No one can read. No one will gonna read because it's all about disability story. And I said, I was really, hurt.
Another publisher agreed to a limited printing. Hong says those 3,000 copies quickly sold out. She now gets a lot of messages from other disabled Koreans. They talk about how her experiences inspired them to travel and try things like paragliding, which she did in Switzerland.
That paragliding section, people really love that one. Mm-hmm. Because they never think that, disabled person can do that kind of sports.
Hong says a wheelchair user doesn't have to go all the way to Europe to try paragliding. They can do that in Korea now. She believes travel and tourism are ways people with and without disabilities can connect with each other.
Suddenly, they meet disabled people in their life. They also can change. They now change their mind. What is disabled people and how to live with disabled people?
And that, Hong adds, is how able-bodied people overcome their biases. For the world, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul.
British holidaymakers in Spain are an unhappy bunch today. Brits flocked there for a warm getaway after the UK lifted its quarantine restrictions on travelers flying in from Spain. But then this weekend, surprise, the British government reimposed a two-week quarantine on people coming back from Spain after cases of COVID-19 spiked in regions like Barcelona. Now tens of thousands of Brits are facing a quarantine at home that they did not expect after their Spanish vacations come to an end. One of them is Stefan Hughes, who spoke with me earlier today.
So right now I'm on a beach in Costa Urdaki in the Funabi area, where it's really popular with British tourists. The beach is full of beach bars and families enjoying themselves. There's loads of restaurants overlooking the sea. It's a really lovely destination. Hopefully you can hear the sea in the background as well. It's so nice to finally be able to go away. I feel safer here than I do in England right now.
Did you expect this would happen? Did you have any idea that these new quarantine restrictions would be reimposed?
Absolutely not, no. I knew there are restrictions in place for other countries, but, that's where our trust in the government lies. They tell us one thing and we say, oh, okay, cool. If they're telling us it's safe to go away and why not? That's what me and my girlfriend thought. Let's go away. Let's try and escape the horrors of the lockdown that we've had to go through. But I think if I knew that Spain was on some kind of increase, then it would have definitely changed my decision.
I mean, lots of people have been worried about how well lockdowns have worked and what happens after lockdowns are lifted and then seeing them reimposed. Was that not a consideration as you were planning this trip to the Canary Islands?
No, not at all. I think after being locked down for so long, the only thing you can do is be optimistic about things and just go, you know what, hey, if the government have said it's okay to go away and, you know, the flights are back online, the main source of income here for the locals is tourism. So, you know, thinking as well that I can go to a place that I've been to before and support these guys who I actually know, you know, some of these people that own the beach bars and some of the staff in the restaurants and the hotels that I regularly visit.
How are those Spanish business owners responding to the news?
They're really frustrated because everything here, especially in Tenerife, I can't speak for the rest of Spain, you know, the Canary Islands, the COVID-19 cases over here have been incredibly low compared to mainland Spain. It's a shame because they're doing their utmost to open up safely, to bring tourists back safely. We have to wear a mask when we're out and about and we can't physically socially distance. All the tables in the restaurants are more than 2 meters apart. All the staff are wearing masks. Mm. You have to disinfect your hands when you go into a restaurant.
Do you think the British government might make an exception for the islands?
I understand that the British government have to act swiftly and they have to make decisions based on data. However, in this case, I think they've made too rash a decision because not only has it's going to affect flights coming out. I think a lot of the airlines have already cancelled flights to the Canary Islands and the Balearic Islands. And if they do go back on themselves and they do make an exemption, I believe there are talks happening, then brilliant. That's great. But we have the data. We have the ability to make more calculated decisions. And I just don't really understand why they didn't do that in the first place.
Stefan Hughes speaking with us from his holiday in the Spanish Canary Islands. I'm sorry about the news about the new quarantine restrictions, but I really hope you and your girlfriend enjoy the rest of your vacation.
Thank you. I think we will. It's going to be a nice time regardless.
Protesters in Israel clashed with police over the weekend. Demonstrators in Jerusalem getting hit there with water cannon. The protesters are angry about a few things. At the top of the list, how the Israeli government's handled the coronavirus. People across Israel are worried about the economic fallout. Here's how one protester put things.
Our Prime Minister, Bibi, Benjamin Netanyahu, is just a symptom of the problem. What we're trying to say is protesting against the whole system, the whole regime that is ignoring us, that is not letting us express ourselves, that's calling us anarchy.
One thing that many Israelis desperately want cleared up right now, a question really parents everywhere want answered, is school happening in the fall? Some parents are looking to success stories. Countries like Norway and Vietnam have reopened schools and kept infection rates low. Israel's experience has been more sobering and may offer some important lessons about what can go wrong if schools are not open the right way. Judah Kaufman has that story from Jerusalem.
Lisa Namdar Kaufman, no relation, had a bad feeling about sending her kids back from the beginning.
Photographs were sent to us from the sixth grade class at the end of the day to show us, look how much fun it is to be back in school.
She's the mother of two boys, ages 11 and 13. They live in the northern Israeli town of Pardes Chana. She says she was nervous about the risk of her sons catching the coronavirus. And those pictures she got from their first day back in school just confirmed her worst fears.
They did all kinds of bonding exercises with the kids all kind of climbing around each other without their masks on. Some kids had initiated this plan. They made a board with nails to hang their masks on, one on top of the other. I was furious and frightened, frankly.
Israel went into a nationwide lockdown in mid-March. Schools stayed closed through April. And then in May, students and teachers started going back to their classrooms. By the beginning of June, dozens of schools, all across the country, were seeing coronavirus outbreaks. They tried to enforce social distancing, but teachers soon threw up their hands. Many Israeli classes have 30 to 40 students each. Lisa Namdar Kaufman says she really feels for the educators.
The kind of social distancing they were asking for was just impossible with the resources at hand, that it wasn't serious, and they didn't take it seriously as a result. And so then each teacher kind of went with whatever they felt comfortable with.
Schools started off the process of reopening gradually, younger kids returned in small groups called capsules. Because of all the extra space, each capsule could have its own classroom. But the situation didn't last long, thanks to the political pressure to get schools up and running more quickly. Rebecca Nussbaum teaches English at a public school in Jerusalem.
To everybody's surprise in the school, on the Thursday night before we were going back on the Sunday, we were in a staff meeting about how the capsulet were going to work, what that would look like. It was 9 o'clock at night, and a news report came out saying that schools were opening as normal.
Nussbaum says she and her colleagues were caught completely off guard. They only had a few days to come up with a new plan.
We did not feel like we had any adequate time to prepare for that in order to make sure that the school was appropriately equipped for that many students coming back in one go.
She says schools were getting mixed messages from the government. For instance, teachers were initially told to have students wear masks in class.
I felt like the second sentence out of my mouth, every second sentence was, please put your mask back on.
But then came a heat wave and new instructions from public officials.
After 2 days of that, the health ministry said it's more likely that you will get heat stroke than coronavirus. So with these extreme heat temperatures, you do not have to wear a mask.
Lev, a 10-year-old student in Tel Aviv, says he was perplexed by what games he could and could not play at recess.
It was very annoying because we were technically allowed to play tag, but we weren't allowed to play soccer. So we made a petition and we got 400 people who won it, but then in the end, just nothing really happened.
Turns out there was a reason for that rule. Students were barred from playing games with balls, fearing they would spread germs. But it's the sort of thing that might have been lost in the forest through the trees. Now, as summer break winds down, Israeli schools are looking ahead to the fall semester. Everybody's hoping to fix some of the mistakes that were made in the spring. Here's Lisa Namdar-Kaufman again, the mom in northern Israel.
They're looking at ways to make the classes smaller, to cycle between days in school and remote learning so that a third of the kids are in school each day. So there's more room to spread out, that kind of thing. It takes planning, and there was no planning when the schools first reopened.
Rebecca, the teacher from Jerusalem, agrees.
I think that with clear guidelines and sufficient time to prepare the schools physically and teachers, it could be more successful. But I think keeping students in smaller groups is... I mean, it's better educationally to have smaller groups of students, and I think that it would also be more beneficial to prevent large outbreaks from occurring.
The outbreaks in schools were blamed for fueling a second wave of coronavirus infections nationwide. In recent weeks, Israel has had more than 1,500 new cases a day. Yochanan Plesner, a former member of parliament and current head of the Israeli Democracy Institute, doesn't think the evidence is clear enough to make that assertion.
The common wisdom is that the single one decision that made the difference in terms of gatherings is when in June it was permitted to allow for events, for weddings and so on, allow for events of up to 250 people, and some of the events were much larger than that. So rather than the school system, the common wisdom now is that if there's one decision that we can go back and unwind, it would be the decision allowing for large events to take place.
Regardless of policy, whether students will return in the fall is largely a matter of trust. Parents need to trust that the school system can keep their children safe. But Plesner says it's looking like public trust in the government's ability to handle the coronavirus is falling apart.
If in mid-May, around 49% of Israelis feared that they would contract the virus, it went up to 57% in the beginning of June, and in the beginning of July, up to 75%.
There's still some time to restore some trust and prepare for the new school year, which begins in late August. For The World, I'm Judah Kaufman in Jerusalem.
Like you, most of us here at The World are working from home, but our virtual newsroom continues to hum, and a lot of that conversation tends to spill out on social media. Find our team of journalists on Twitter. The handle is easy to remember. We're at The World. If you want to see my own spillage, you can find me at Marco Werman. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.